He says, so you stand up saying black folks is pushed in a corner like a Black Panther. He would say, yeah, we should name it the Black Panther. Black Panther Party, because we're going to have a political party. I says, right, Huey. I says, and what about the self-defense factor? You know, because Malcolm X says that self-defense is active intelligence. We're talking about self-defense. He says, okay, Black Panther Party for self-defense. You know, we're all enthusiastic. We're young and fervent. Yeah, we have the Black Panther Party.
That's Bobby Seale, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Bobby Seale on the Black Panther Party. In the 1960s and 70s, the Black Panther Party captured the imagination of millions in the United States and around the world with its iconic Black Power salutes and revolutionary rhetoric. The organization also attracted the attention of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI launched a sustained counterintelligence program to infiltrate, disrupt, and destroy the Panthers. The media and popular history have focused on gun-toting Panther militancy and ignored the group's dedication to community organizing and providing much-needed social services. Education and information were key aspects of their work. What Bobby Seale said in Oakland in 1968, "We have to learn to see what's going on," is as relevant today as it was then. To talk about the Black Panther Party is someone uniquely placed to do so, Bobby Seale. He, along with Huey P. Newton, started the Black Panther Party. He was its first chairperson. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And now, Bobby Seale.
Founding and the creation of the Black Panther Party came out of my heart, mind, and soul. Mine and Huey's heart, mind, and soul. I mean, I know exactly. Everybody trying to define what the Black Panther Party was in terms of their Marxist, Leninist, whatever, fine. And I'm not saying you're not sincere about human liberation and an end to exploitation. And I'm the same way. I want to get rid of and evolve out of existence avaricious, racist, corporate monopoly capitalists. But don't sit up here and try to tell me I was there. I mean, I know what the FBI did do. I know what COINTELPRO did. COINTELPRO was a counterintelligence program of the FBI. They sent in a lot of provocateur agents. Through the years, by the end of 1969, we had 28 Black Panther Party members dead. But there was also 14 policemen dead in those goddamn shootouts. They wounded 64 of us. We wounded 32 of them. And again, it's not about numbers. It's about standing on our constitutional, democratic, civil human rights to organize our people in the black community, whether the racist pig-ass power structure, as we used to say, whether they like it or not. The real, true, numerical demise of the Black Panther Party, the numerical demise of the Black Panther Party, had to do with a strategic organizing mistake that the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party made. Prior to the mayoralty campaign in 1973, but in January of 72, Huey suggested in the Central Committee meeting, the Central Committee that I had gotten expanded after I'm out of jail, and it included some two-thirds black females because I expanded it to all the coordinators who had done all the hard work to Maine and it happened to be sisters. So we expanded the Central Committee to that. Huey had a problem of wanting this absolute control. I had a need from Jump Street, always wanting a mass political organization and multiple leadership and community committee leadership. That was the difference between me and Huey. Eldridge Cleaver, he says, I made the mistake. He said, I was a hoodlum. He said, even though I could write and all that stuff, he said, but I wanted a shootout every time you turn around. So Eldridge tended to lean towards the anarchistic activity. Huey Newton fell into the trap of wanting to control of the criminal activity. And me, I'm so naive, but I still was always about organizing a national mass membership, political, electoral, black community machine in the coalition frameworks with other white, radical, left, black, Hispanic, whoever. Because our true slogan of the Black Panther Party was not black power. It was not black power. It was all power to all the people. And you got a whole lot of people sitting in this audience old enough to testify to that fact. All power to all the people. And even when Fred Hampton said, And somebody said, what you mean just all power to all the people? He said, brother, we're talking some black power to black people, some red power to red people, some brown power to brown people. We're talking about some white power to poor and low-income and progressive white people. We're talking about some yellow power to yellow people. He said, when you put it all together, it's all power to all the people. So it's power to the people. I am a revolutionary. Says, I mean, this is Fred Hampton. So I'm just trying to say that the Black Panther Party did have a class analysis. Let's go back. Hugh was in night law school, and how we decided to patrol the police had to do with an organization called the CAP organization in Los Angeles that evolved a couple of months after the Watts riots in 1965. Now, let you get your dates straight here. I want you to get your dates straight. The Black Panther Party that Huey and I founded, originally titled the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, was founded in October of 1966. The CAP organization in Los Angeles, 400 miles south of Oakland, California, San Francisco, Oakland, California, was called Community Alert Patrol. This was a group of black citizens and a handful of whites and others who did not want to see any more vicious acts of police brutality in the Watts community following the 1965 Watts riots, because what sparked the 1965 Watts riots was a vicious act of racist police brutality in the Watts community. That's what sparked the riot. So this group had law books, had tape recorders, and armbands, CAP, and they would ride around in cars. And they announced themselves in the press, in public, and said that we are observing the police in hopes that the police see us as responsible citizens observing them. They will not commit any more acts of police brutality because we don't want the community burnt down anymore. Remember the Watts riots? Older people remember it. August 1965. That CAP organization evolved right around late September, October. After 2 or 3 months out there, the police, in effect, took their law books and tore them up, took their tape recorders and smashed them up, beat them up, and drug them downtown and locked them up. That sparked an interest. It was all in the press on the part of Huey. Huey was concerned with the fact that, as far as he was concerned, their rights had been violated. First Amendment rights, the right of the people to peacefully assemble and or to redress their grievances, but to patrol the police. So Huey began to try to research in and out of Knight Law School, San Francisco Law School, which was a private law school. Huey researched that, and he found a law. He didn't find a law. He found a California Supreme Court ruling that said all citizens had a right to stand and observe a police officer carrying out their duty as long as they stood a reasonable distance away. He found it. In other words, Huey was always an advocate. We were not opposed to nonviolent protests. What we were opposed to is the racist power structure and the racist government attacking peaceful people in peaceful protest. That's what we were opposed to. Our advocacy, even from Huey's standpoint and mine, is that the people had a right to peacefully redress their grievances by the said First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America. So this organization, the Black Panther Party, was one of the most hellified organizations in the country. We were attacked. We were screwed over. We were attacked by COINTELPRO. We did numerous people. There's a new book coming out called FBI Secrets. South End Press is publishing this book. This is the documentation by a former FBI agent. And in the book, he documents and brings up how FBI, using provocateur agents, actually killed six of those 28 party members I was telling you about. Had them murdered. All as a means to try to terrorize us out of existence. But by 1972, late 71, 72, all attacks, overt gun attacks on the Black Panther Party stopped. They stopped. Primarily because people like Roy Wilkins, NAACP, and others, and Congressman Dillums and some others, moved, and Ted Kennedy and some others, moved to get an investigation of the FBI's concerted attempt to smash the Black Panther Party. One of the reasons more Roy Wilkins moved was because after Fred Hampton was murdered December 4th, 1969, at a pre-dawn raid, 5 a.m. in Chicago, by State's Attorney Hanahan and his special squad. They broke in the back door and the front door and shot. That was all a terroristic campaign to try to terrorize us out of existence. And 2 days later, they attacked the Black Panther Party office in Los Angeles. And it's documented in the newspapers, in the regular daily newspapers, that J. Edgar Hoover and Ronald Reagan, who was then governor of California, had just had a conversation day before about the impending attack they was going to make on the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party, which turned out to be a four-hour shootout and battle. But we had organized against that. Not so much that we was going to win a battle, to survive. And even though I was in jail, and using my old architectural and design skills, months earlier, I was sending out three-dimensional sketches of how to sandbag all the way up to the windowsills, how to take and find the joist in the ceiling, main joist in the ceiling, get heavy-duty hinge systems. Take a three-quarter-inch piece of plywood, cut it down to the size of the window, lay it all the way across, put a major hooks and hook it up to the bolts that you send straight up through the joists and bolt in there, and also bolt that three-quarter-inch piece of plywood to a half-inch piece of steel, complete with porthole shooting portholes. So when the police come by, hit those hooks, slam down to the window, get behind the sandbags, and shoot it out. Why? Because we were standing on the principle of our moral concepts of moral, secular, constitutional, democratic, civil, human rights to organize our people in our black community with a racist-ass pig power structure, liked it or not. In other words, talking about I'd rather be dead in my grave than ever be a slave. Well, them brothers and sisters, eight brothers and eight sisters in there. When the police first hit that building, it was a two-story building. When they hit that building, December the 6th, 2 days after Fred Hampton was murdered, 1969, when they busted the bottom doors and busted through the big wooden bar section that went across the front of the doors, when they opened up, you know, we always had a handful of ex-Vietnam vets in the Black Panther Party, like Geronimo Pratt. When they opened the doors, a batter rammed the doors. What happened there is that all the desks and the chairs was stacked up in a long line going straight back. It was a pretty good-sized office, large office. And when the first SWAT team came in with their bulletproof vests and their helmets, busted through the door, you know, they like to come in the door and go right and then go left. They couldn't go nowhere. And when they couldn't go nowhere, them brothers and sisters at the tail end, four of them, two on one side, one on the floor, they both leaned out, double old buckshot, bloom, 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 and laid the first three of them straight out. Police come up there and drug their wounded out, and they retreated. They had 300 SWAT team. Wouldn't let nobody come in. Then State Senator Dimley, a black state senator, black state assemblyman at the time, of that district, came down. He was two blocks away. Police jumped on him and whooped him and beat him up. That Los Angeles Police Department has been a hellfire police department before the Black Panther Party, through the Black Panther Party, after the Black Panther Party, right on up through Rodney King, and today, the Los Angeles racist-ass pig police department, I'm telling you. I mean, but I'm just saying, we went through it too with them. So, I mean, that was a shootout and battle. We only got one person wounded. Then when we got in court, we won the case. Police, well, the reason we attacked is because Officer so-and-so drove by and he noticed in the upstairs window a Black Panther walking with an AR-16 up on his shoulder, which appeared to be a automatic weapon, and automatic weapons being illegal, boom, 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 boom. And preliminary hearing, he said, and this judge happened to be one of the white liberal judge, he said, why ain't you out there arresting some of them Ku Klux Klanners with some AR-16s? Because the reason is what we had was semi-automatic AR-16. They were not automatic. That's right. And the judge says you can buy these semi-automatics every day in the week down at the gun shop, and threw this out of court. And we done shot up. They didn't kill the cops, but they shot their ass up pretty bad. So I'm just saying, standing and fighting in battles back in the 60s, when the power structure on all fronts was about smashing all organizational frameworks, whether you were communist, whether you were socialist, whether you were anti-war, whether you were anti-demonstration, anti-institutionalized racism or whatever, they jumped on people, beat them up, brutalized them, about terrorizing them. And it's not nothing new to America. The powers that be, the corporate money rich on back, all the way back to the founding beginning of this very country, have jumped on the people and tried to jump anybody who was protesting or redressing their grievances on any significant level. In the 1960s, the Black Panther Party evolved. We were like a social evolutionary accident. When I say a social evolutionary accident in the positive sense, though, in an ongoing civil rights protest movement that already existed, because we came about in 1966 with a 10-point platform and program. As I say, in my early days, to walk across the street in 1962 and see these brothers in some group called the Afro-American Association, and that's the first day I heard their name and first day I seen them, and the brother Donald Warden, and there was Richard Thorne, and Jim Thomas, and Kenny Freeman, and quite a few other people that, Richard Thorne, who was, they call him Richard Thorne, that's what Huey didn't know the guy's real name. His real name was William Brumfield, who I knew, but he was older than me, but standing there talking about our history, you know, talking about mentioning names like Richard Wright and W.B. Du Bois. Here I am, 26 years old. I had never even heard of these people. The Ghana Kingdom and the Mali Kingdom and the Sangi Kingdom and the Zimbabwe. I never knew such a thing existed. This is 1962, spring. I'm an engineering design major, working a full-time job at night at Kaiser Aerospace Electronics. I'm running around with my little Ivy League all sharp down, you know, winking at the sisters, letting them know I'm into something, you know, that kind of crap. And these brothers are talking about some black history. And they says, we ain't Negroes, we ain't colored, we are Afro-American. We are African-Americans, Afro-Americans, because our descendancy is from Africa. You got Chinese schools in Chinese town where Chinese people can learn about Chinese people. So you can go to Jewish schools where Jewish people can learn about Jewish people. He says, all other kind of ethnic schools where people can go to people and learn about people. He said, but here we are, I have a white-controlled school here, and some white people go there, but there's some black people going there, but all we learn about is white people. We ain't learned nothing about no black folks. They say, even when you was in grammar school, he said they had Dick, Jane, and Spot, the little primer books to try to teach you how to read. The only goddamn thing that was black in the book is the spot on the back of Spot's back. But see, it was 1963 when Dick Gregory came to our campus. Dick Gregory came to our campus. I've been reading a year now because I done digested Black Reconstruction. I've digested Basil Davidson, Slave Trade. I've digested and went over it three or four times. Marvel J. Herskovitz's work called The Myth of the Negro Past. If you ever want to read some real dissertative stuff, read and digest The Myth of the Negro Past. Soul of Black Folks by W.B. Du Bois, et cetera, and so on. We can just go on and on and on and on and on. And Dick Gregory came to our class to explain to us how him, with a lot of other young people, students, blacks, and some whites, had went down to try to integrate the restaurants and Woolworths down in the South. And Dick Gregory explained that they all ran in, went down and sit down on every stool at the lunch counter inside of Woolworths. And the white proprietor walks over and looks at Dick Gregory and says, we don't serve niggers here. And Dick Gregory said, you know, I don't eat them things no way. Could you please give me a hamburger? When Dick told us that at our Merritt College Auditorium at Oakland, California, I mean, you know, I used to be a stand-up comedian, too. They call me a hoodlum. I'm a hunter and a fisherman from a very young age. I own my own 30-30 Winchester at age 12. My father taught me to be a carpenter. I'm an architect. I did stage acting, jazz drama, structure repair, high-performance aircraft, non-destruct testing, etc. And also, I wrote a cookbook called Barbecuing with Bobby. It is the only down-home, hickory-smoked, southern-style barbecue cookbook guide in America. The problem is everybody says, why did he write a cookbook? I said, goddamn, revolutionaries eat too. But more important, the real reason I wrote the cookbook and got it published in 1988 because me and some former Black Panther Party members were trying to put together a fundraising scheme methodology to raise some 20-some-odd thousand or 50-some-odd thousand dollars. We have 26, 28,000 abandoned houses and properties in Philadelphia. And we were going to try to go after some of these properties, which we can get some, we can get a $500 or $1,000, and some in cheap sales. But we were going to try to accumulate 20 of those properties and go after some more funds to create an environmental renovation youth jobs project, using professionals to train youth how to renovate housing and pay them not the minimum wage, start them off at $7 an hour, and also renovate old cars. That's what the cookbook was written for. I mean, old socialist buddies, oh, he wrote a cookbook. Oh, he sold out the struggle. And don't know what the goddamn hell the struggle is. You know what I mean? When it comes, it is a contradiction. And I am nobody's capitalist, but it is still a contradiction to try to live, survive, or organize in a capitalistic social order against the avariciousness and racism of a capitalistic social order. It is a contradiction to try to do it in a capitalistic social order with no capital. I mean, how are you going to pay the mimeographs? How are you going to pay the people to print this and do this and the phone bills and that? It's kind of, you know what I mean? To me, money is only a medium of exchange for services and goods. A year and a half ago, I mean, 150 years ago, there was approximately 1 billion living human beings on the face of this earth. Now, by 2010, we're talking about 6 billion, not million, the B word, billion living human beings on the face of this earth. It is about how do we reorganize. The medium of exchange of money is going to be here. But how do we creatively reorganize some new economic practices? I mean, I have a lot of arguments with a lot of people. They don't want to see it. Well, I'm going to try to keep doing what I'm doing because I think it's a political and a revolutionary humanist way. This is my true ideology. I'm a revolutionary humanist. I'm not even a black nationalist. And the brother goes, oh, he ain't no black nationalist. Oh, man, he don't even believe in no black unity. I do believe in black unity, African-American people's unity. I also believe in Native American people's unity. You see what I'm getting at? I believe in a whole lot of human beings and people's unity. But I believe in black unity, African-American people's unity, only as a catalyst to help humanize the world. Only as a catalyst to help humanize the world. I mean, this is very, very important. And to be a revolutionary. To be a revolutionary about it. I mean, to organize and raise the consciousness of people, to put them on a level, even in an environmental renovation youth jobs project program, where we teach human resources skills, we also teach revolutionary principles, revolutionary humanist principles. And this is what kind of program. Now, the power structure may say, well, we're going to have to go down there and attack that nigger seal. Come on with it, brother. Because we I stand on the same principle. If you start shooting at me because I'm exercising my constitutional, democratic, civil, human rights to organize and teach and educate and raise the conscience of my people, I'm shooting back to defend that principle. And it's no different from the Black Panther Party. When me and Huey wrote the 10-point platform and program of the Black Panther Party and the War on Poverty Office, we were in the War on Poverty Office, and we used the A.B. Dick machine, the Stetson burner machine of the government. We used the government paper, the government ink, and the government paychecks to rent our first office that I wrote and painted the sign, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Very neat office, because I didn't want to disrespect my black folks in the black community. I wanted them to see some organizing, an organization that represented organization. We want power, number one. Determine our own destiny, we wrote. On poverty, don't determine our own destiny, our own black community. Number two, we want full employment for our people, period. Because we had 10 more collateral points. But the first 10 points, we had to come on the basis of what our real grassroots community was coming from. Number three, we want decent housing fit for shelter of human beings, period. We want decent education that teaches us about our true history, period. We want an end to the white, we want an end to the black community of the robbery of the black community by the white racist capitalists, period. We want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people, period. We want all black people to be exempt from any kind of military service, period. When all black brothers and sisters were brought to trial to be tried by a jury of their peers as confined by the Constitution of the United States, period. All black brothers and sisters who've already been tried by all white juries have a right to another trial because they have not been represented by their peers. Those are the first 10 points. We wrote 10 more points collateralizing that of what we believe. But we get the brothers and sisters in the community to read the basic, simple first point. We didn't want no religion. I will have no religion in this damn organization. It will not be based on religion. Because I had a problem. I mean, I like the sincerity of the Nation of Islam. But to me, they were behind the struggle. We wrote the 10-point platform and program. Now, I said, period, housing, education. We had witnessed in some so-called motivational programs that some of the other brothers and sisters had tried, where they paid the youth $1.65 minimum wage to sit in a class and to be motivated. The brothers would come from college and hear these poor, low-income brothers and sisters. The basic socioeconomic structure and the adverse conditions that you're subjected to and considering particular sociological and psychological factors against the backdrop in the history of slavery. You see, the young brother, hey, man, what they talking about, man? He don't know what the fuck they're talking about. We say, we want full employment for our people. Yeah, right on, brother. I know what you're talking about. We want to meet it in the police brutality and murder of black people. Tell it. Y'all can do something about that, boy. That'd be... You're clicking. We wrote the 10-point platform program. And after Melvin Newton helped us with some grammar and stuff, me and Huey went up a second night, and Huey went upstairs in the law library at the Legal Aid Service. I was trying to research and try to find some last piece, something his law professor told him. And just as he found what he found, I found something. Well, Huey found the ruling. California Supreme Court ruling gave the citizens the right to observe police officers because we had decided we was going to move on point number 7 and was going to do the same thing the CAP organization had done in Los Angeles a year early with law books and tape recorders. Only the difference was since they beat up the CAP organization or since they beat up civil rights protesters, since they even jump on young white protesters who also protest against institutionalized racism in America, since they beat up on them, we're going to take some guns with us. And Huey had researched all the laws on the guns. As long as the gun was not concealed at that time in California law, it was not illegal. He was saying, furthermore, for instance, if we're riding in the car, he said, I notice here you can't have a live round in the chamber of a rifle or a shotgun when you're riding in the car. In other words, that means when we get out of the car, then only then could we jack the round off into the chamber. And we could have it in the magazine, we couldn't have it in the chamber. I said, what about handguns? I said, because I'm carrying a 45. He said, it doesn't apply to handguns. You can have a live round in the chamber. Furthermore, he would find another law one day. He says, you know, when we go out and we start patrolling the police, he says, I think what we're going to have to do is that, Bobby, you're going to have to show us the best how to do weapons because you've been in the military. I says, well... He said, because we can't really point the weapon at the police officer unless he actually attempts to shoot at us first. It's a fine particular thing a lot of he was dealing with. I says, why, Huey? He said, well, he said, if you have a live round in the chamber, which constitutes a loaded weapon, and you point that weapon at somebody, and unless you're in a situation where you have to defend yourself, he said, that loaded weapon constitutes, pointing a loaded weapon at somebody constitutes assault with a deadly weapon under California law. I said, wait a minute. I said, well, what if we're just playing around? He said, there's another ruling here in another court system. He says, if a person just playing around, it's a live round in the chamber, he or she has no intention of shooting a person, and if it's a live round in the chamber of a rifle or a handgun, long gun or handgun, he said, it constitutes assault with a deadly weapon. This is where the Black Panther Party came from, brothers and sisters. It was a scrutiny that I and Huey had been putting to that whole civil rights protest movement that I had been putting to it since 62. So, October 66, around the 15th or 16th, we finished writing the 10-point platform program. But we didn't have a name for the organization. We wrote the 10-point program before we even had a name.
You're listening to Bobby Seale, the Black Panther Party. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
A few days later, I got a letter from the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. But the Lowndes County on the Mississippi side, it said the Mississippi Lowndes County Freedom Organization. On the other side is an Alabama one, but there's also a Mississippi one. Or is it Arkansas? Oh, I forget. Anyway, and they had a silhouette of a logo of a panther. Didn't say Black Panther, nothing, just had a silhouetted logo of a panther. I said, damn, Huey, I says, what is this logo, this thing they got here? He said, well, you know, it's a white racist organization down there, have a logo of a fighting cock, a rooster, you know what I mean? I said, that's interesting. I said, but why they got this panther? Well, I think it was the next day, October 22nd, Huey said, you know, I think the nature of a panther is that if you push it in the corner, if it can't go left and it can't go right to get out of the way of the aggressor who's pushed it in the corner, it's going to tend to come out of that corner to wipe that aggressor out, to try to get out of the corner that's been pushed in. I said, but damn, you asked it just like Black people. He said, what you saying? I said, man, now look, you're always talking about how the racist power structure is always violating the civil rights, the constitutional rights, the First Amendment, the Constitution for People to Peaceful Register Grievances. I said, then we got the signature sign down there calling for a community police review board. I say, and the city council told the advisory board at the Warren Poverty Office to hell with them. I said, then the CAP organization down there, I says they took away their rights, and you found a Supreme Court ruling said they had a right to observe it. He said, so you said, I'm saying Black folks is pushed in a corner like a Black Panther. He would say, yeah, we should name it the Black Panther Party, because we're going to have a political party. I says, right, Huey. I says, and what about the self-defense factor? You know, because Malcolm X says that self-defense is active intelligence. We're talking about self-defense. He says, okay, Black Panther Party for self-defense. You know, we're all enthusiasts. We're young and fervent. Yeah, we have the Black Panther Party. Little Bobby Hutton walked upon us in my driveway there. And he said, what you guys talking about? He would say, we're talking about the new organization. He said, we got the 10-point program. All we got to do is print it up now. He said, we're going to call the Black Panther Party for self-defense. And he would say, yeah, when the Panther roars, the world trembles. You know, we was going through the... We were young and fervorous, but we were well-read and insightful, getting ready to take a chance because Malcolm X had been killed, and that's what I told Huey, that we had to start a new organization. 1 week after Malcolm X was killed, it took a year and a half to get this organization off the ground. Because first I organized the Black History Fact Group at Merritt College campus. Then I organized Soul Students Advisory Council at Merritt College campus. Then we got in a fight with some police in the spring of 66. Then we had to go to court. Then we got probation. And then I said, Huey, man, we almost went to jail. We got to organize the organization. That's what we finally came with after we wrote the 10-point platform and program. And that night, another night, that other night prior to that, we stuck the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence to the end of the 10-point platform and program. And we etched it out on the stencil, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, settlement, and we ran off 1,000 copies of the 10-point platform and program with the government paper and everything. He would say, you think they're going to miss the paper? I said, I don't care. You know? So finally what we did is we put together some money a couple months or so later. We got our office. Little Bobby Hutton joined. A couple other brothers joined. We had a nice little office, so we started teaching brothers and sisters the 10-point platform and program. Emerge magazine printed something back here 2 years ago in which they quote, and I think they misquoted Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, because they say, Kwame Ture say, you can't just put a gun in somebody. That is not the way we did that. First, you had to know how to take an arrest. First, you had to know the 10-point platform program. Then we found out three of the brothers were semi-illiterate. They had to be taught how to read, and we used Malcolm X's recent published autobiography to teach them how to read. The rest of the brothers were avid readers. The Forte brothers were avid readers. John Salone was an old military boy. He was an avid reader when we got him to. Big man Albert Howard was in college, like Huey and I had been, you know, et cetera. But I'm just saying, the first time, if we were meeting our office every week, our sign, Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. One night, some guy busted in, when does karate classes start? Said, brother, it's not about karate class. Then he looked, said, damn, man, what you guys doing with all these guns? You know, all these guns. Just like... So we're a political organization, man. The Black Panther Party, we're talking about organizing black community, electoral community power in our black community. It's not the whole liberation, but it's a stepping stone. And it's a conscious raising effort that we're going to get into. And we have meetings on seven political education sessions, 7 p.m. Wednesday night and 2 p.m. Saturday afternoons. Oh, I thought it was karate, man. Anyway, we took the brother. I mean, for several weeks, we took these brothers through various kinds of reading material. There was reading book lists, a whole kind of lot of stuff. And they had to go through the whole process. And after the political education session, everybody had to learn how to break down weapons and put them back together. Whether they were 9mm Astros, whether they were M1 carbines, we were ragtag. All of our weapons were not exactly alike. We did not have all shotguns. Some couple of shotgun, long shotgun, a short shotgun, you know, a carbine, an old M1 and a new M1 carbine, the smaller one, the handier one, the lighter one, you know what I mean? 45, a 9mm. What was that? One of them had a 44, etc. And Sister Mona Laba was the first sister to join. I'll never forget it, after we'd had about a month of meetings, because she passed by a couple of times on Saturday and gave us the finger and walked away. Say, what that sister do that for? So little Bobby ran the door and ran out to, hey, sister, what you do that for? She was going down the street. So two Saturdays later, here she come by. She come, because we had these big bay windows you could see right in, you know, from the streets. Big bay windows came down here, you know, boom. And she walked by. She said, there she is again. Somebody said, there she is. We looked around. She's gone. Sister Mata Laba. Blew my mind. So the next Saturday, I was waiting for that sister. And sure as hell, she came down. I ran the door. I said, sister, why are you doing that to us? I says, why? She says, I don't like you. I said, sister, we are a black community organization. We just started up. We're trying to organize some black community unity in our black community. I know that. I said, why you give us the finger? I don't like you because you don't allow women in the Black Panther Party, your Black Panther Party. I said, that's not true. Yes, it is, because every time I come by here, all I see is you brothers there. And sometimes you be your little classes, and other times you be cleaning your guns and stuff. I said, sister, it is not true that we don't allow women. Yes, it is. I said, wait a minute, sister. We ain't got an application. I said, here's an application. I said, sister, he or she who assumes without investigation, 9 times out of 10 is dead wrong. I said, you assume that. All you have to do is walk in the office and say, can I join? I said, come on in. You can join. She said, you mean I can really do it? I says, come in. You know, little Bobby Hutton, we got a few street brothers. They sister fine as you is, you know you can do it. You know? And I'm just saying, she walked in and said, see that? There he goes. I said, Bobby, be cool. I'm sorry, sister. I'm sorry. I said, now, sister, you can join the Black Panther Party. She says, I don't trust y'all. All right, she said, if I could join the Black Panther Party, can I have a gun just like the brothers? I said, sister, you can have a gun just like the brothers. You mean I read? I says, yes. She says, okay, I'll join. I'll be glad. Anyway, I was the first sister in the Black Panther Party. So finally, after we got everybody trained how to take an arrest, Huey went through over and over and over how that when we start patrol, because we had not started patrolling police yet, we had a lot of training to do those first 8 weeks or so. How to take an arrest. How not to say anything. Remember, Huey was off in the law school a year at this time. And he had defended himself in a couple of traffic cases. And he won one of them, too. I'll never forget that. The judge says, and why didn't you get out of the car when the police said, he says, Your Honor, she was a female judge, the reason I didn't get out of the car, because these policemen brutalized you, so therefore I was afraid to get out of the car in the growly manner in which he asked me to get out. He would get in the courtroom. He won that case. I never forget that. But those are the early days. I'm just trying to say he loved the law. He loved to test the law. But here we are getting ready to go on patrol. Finally, we tell everybody. So everybody has to have a black beret, black leather jacket. If you ain't got a black leather jacket, you can have a black bush jacket. But you have to have some black slacks or pants that must be clean, shine your shoes, black gloves, blue shirts starched and ironed with a turtleneck or a black scarf or whatever, and a black beret. You know, and some of you, we had 5 or 6, about 12 of us. Half of us had long guns, half of us had sidearms. No weapon, not even the sidearms, were concealed. And we was doing the same thing the CAP organization was doing, only we had a political organization with a document behind it. And, you know, we took hundreds of copies of the 10-point platform and program. Well, we got not only the 10-point platform and program, but we got the rules of the Black Panther Party, the first 10 rules we wrote. And here you see the first 10 rules and the 28 extended rules that I made in 1968. We're out to 28 rules as the organization grew. But in 1966, early 67, is when we're doing this early patrolling. So we get in Huey's daddy's father's car one night and my old Chevrolet car. And we load it down, six in one car and six in another car. So the idea was we would ride until we see a police officer having stopped someone. Because our intent was not necessarily to get in a shootout, but our guns were loaded. We knew better. We never went to the street without our guns being loaded or without having ammunition. But when we ride in the car, we would not have a live round in the chamber, but we have live rounds in the magazine. Law books and tape recorders in the uniform. I put the tape recorder around little Bobby Hutton's shoulder, strapped that, and, you know, when we got ready to get out of the car, we turned it on. But we saw this policeman on 7th Street down in the red light district, short in hell, with some young brother standing up against the car being searched. Well, what is he? Off the curb then, the wide sidewalk over here, and it's 50 or 60 black folks, some standing, some walking through, and some looking at the police going through arrest. We stopped down here, got out of the car, got the guns, took the tape recorder, put around a little Bobby, I turned the tape recorder on, you know, how to get the badge, and told party members to remember the policeman's badge number. And he says, now remember, the police has to say something to us first. He said, but I don't want everybody talking. And he went over this in PE classes many weeks before that. He said, because if we ever, he said, we got a method by which we will take the arrest if they officially arrest us without trying to shoot us. But if they try to shoot at us, we will defend ourselves also. He said, but we take the arrest, he says, and if we have to go to court, one person talks. Either I talk or Bobby talks. Everybody listen. He said, because if we all get arrested when we get in court, he says, it's better having 10 or 12 brothers testifying to the same exact story than having 10 or 12 people all trying to say something at one time. And he said this, you don't have a good chance with a jury. And see, so it goes back to a degree of Huey's understanding of, one, the grassroots relationship of where we were coming from in our comfort. And then we was putting civil rights on a cutting edge at this point, because we was going to patrol these coasts with guns and tape recorders and law books. So here we are, we come out, walk down 100 feet till we get in front of the crowd, we step off the curb and step in front of the people, we spread it across 40 feet, and as Huey gets over to the forward area where the police is, he's got a shotgun and a law book, and it's dark, it's about 8 o'clock or something, 7, 8 o'clock, it's dark, and as we get there, you know how black people are, it takes them a little time to really see what's going on. And somebody say, hey, man, them dudes got guns. Somebody say, all these mother got guns, man. And another brother says, down there by Huey, I'm getting the hell out of here. And when he said that, Huey says, nope, nope, nope. It's not necessary for you to leave, brother. Come back, come back. All of you are citizens here. We've read the law. You have a right to stand and observe this police officer carrying out their duty. We're a new organization, the Black Panther Party, and we're here to observe these police who brutalize our people in the community. By this time, the police are standing here listening to Huey say what he's got to say. The young brother up here in the rest of them saying, the police are looking at Huey. Huey's about over there. You have no right to observe me. Huey says, no, according to, and he'll wrap these numbers up. According to such and such a Supreme Court ruling, every citizen has a right to stand and observe a police officer carrying out their duty. Wait a minute, as long as they stand a reasonable distance away. He said, in that particular ruling, a reasonable distance was constituted as 8 to 10 feet. I'm standing approximately 20 feet from you, and I'll observe you whether you like it or not. And when he said that, whether you like it or not, well, you have to imagine all these black folks. And when he says, whether you like it or not, some sisters say, well, go ahead on and tell it. And another brother says, what kind of niggas is these, man? Huey, the police says, well, I got a right to, Huey says, no, you cannot. Huey says, is that gun loaded? He says, I have the right to see if that gun is loaded. Huey says, no, no, no. Huey went off into some legal point about how It's not only due process of law, but how you cannot remove a person's property from them without due process of law. And he cited some rulings, some synopsized sightings. Therefore, you cannot touch my private property. If you want it, you're going to have to take it, because you cannot remove my property from without due process of law. He says, I got a right. The police say, is that gun loaded? And you would say, if I know it's loaded, that's good enough. You know what had happened? When we had gotten out of the car with the guns, all the people with the long guns had never jacked a round off into the chamber, right? And he says, if I know it's loaded, that's good enough. And I guess it dawned on Huey, he never jacked a round off in the chamber when he got out of the car. It was the first night's patrol, right? Huey says, it's loaded. What did he say? When Huey did that, the other brothers with the long gun says, that's right, I ain't got... Well, a cop really hadn't looked at nobody but me. Let's see, it was Huey, me, Marta Laba, little Bobby, and the rest of them scattered down that way. When the cop looked around, well, all these jacking around, this brother of yours said, hey, brother, don't y'all shoot this way. And the police looked away to see all these people jacking around. And then that's when he realized this 30, 40 foot long of disciplined Panthers jacking rounds off in the chamber. While we jacking rounds off in the chamber, clack, 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 you know what the black folks is doing. Uh-oh, boy. I mean, there was a scene that shook the police when he saw it. He got his arrestee and opened the door. He says, come on, get in. Go ahead. Shut his front door over here, sat and ran around the side and looked around and got in his car and drove off. That's exactly what we wanted. Why? Because we got stacks of 10-point platform and program. Remember, this is an organization, not just to be bad and tough. We would have to organize the brothers and the sisters. And it was a methodology by which we were attempting to capture the imagination of the people in the community by addressing the viciousness of overt police brutality, by observing the police with guns, following the law to the letter. So there we was, talking to the people there. That we have political education sessions at 5600 Grove Street, the Black Panther Party's office. We're about coming out and organizing a new political electoral community power. And hopefully one day, when we do get organized, we'll try to take over the city government of Oakland to set examples for numerous black communities around the country so that we begin to make some stepping stones to our future liberation. Blah, 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 blah. Please be at our political education sessions, because you don't necessarily have to carry guns. You can work on some of the other programs and help create some more community. This is what we were doing. For the half an hour that we were there, we got in the car, we go to my house, we get to my house, I surprised all the buddies, but they knew I cooked anyway. I got this big, giant vat of my hickory sirloin chili with long grain rice and fried cornbread. I mean, you know, and then my sister then breaks in, she comes from my church an hour later, my brother comes in, my sister comes in. It's all over West Oakland that you guys had shot some policemen and ran them off. What are you doing, my sister said. I said, Betty, sit down, please. Ain't nobody shot nobody. We just patrolled the police, and the police ran off. And now the people and took the people exaggerated. But we hadn't shot nobody. The police left. My brother came in. He's a bus driver. Man, you know it's down at the Alameda Country Costa Pooh Hall, man, that y'all down there and ran up some police. Just patrolling. Boom, we all ate, et cetera. Brothers are trying to read France Fanon and others, et cetera. You know, so that's where the Black Panther Party grew out of really researching and studying history of African and African-American people's struggle. And I bring all of that home to say this, brothers and sisters. When I say that I consider myself to be a revolutionary humanist, I am trying to have a broader concept. I'm trying to take into account all of humanity on earth. I'm trying to take into account the avaricious, racist, corporate, monopoly, capitalistic frameworks in the world who are perpetually exploiting us. I'm trying to take into account some of the arguments that I've had with some of my old state-controlled socialist buddies and friends of the past. I mean, they were concerned, etc., but I refuse to accept state-controlled command economy socialism. I accepted democratic socialism. I accepted cooperative socialism. But another thing I rejected was the linealectic mechanistic way in which dialectics is presented by Hegel, Engels, Marx, and Lenin. It is not that they were not sincere, but a lot of people in the old doctrinaire sense refuse to move on and refuse to understand that even Marx and Lenin and Hegel had enough sense to know that knowledge is a forward movement. It is not about stagnation. So when I argued against some of my old contemporaries in 1968, with quite a few, I says, I am about evolving more community control of economic frameworks that retail and produce services and goods. Oh, no, that's patchwork socialism. I says, bull, what do you talk about? You talk about the workers controlling the means of production, right? Right. I say, okay, I'm saying that every damn worker you talking about lives in a community, so it's about community control of economic frameworks that retail and produce services and goods under constitutional democratic civil human rights that people should exercise, and not about some state control that's going to take away the basic democratic human rights of the people. Because if the people begin to understand that they are the true synthesis between the thesis and the antithesis. And it's not just one thesis or antithesis, it's a polylectic range of theses and antitheses that's interconnected and interrelated. People got to understand we are not living anymore in 1960s or the 1980s. We are living in the 90s and kicking fast and hard. When I say this is an overdeveloped, fast-paced, computerized, scientific, technological, social law that's largely controlled by a bunch of avaricious, racist, corporate monopoly capitalists, when they talk about the goddamn world order, I'm saying we in our communities, community level, community organizing, I'm talking about neighborhood level. One of the best dialectical principles I remember reading and pulling out of all that old material we used to read was quantitative increase, quantitative decrease causes a qualitative leap or change. It had possibilities for me when I read it. It was the basis of mathematics. I remember Huey, he never could talk to a big audience. He never knew how to motivate him, although he was a sincere brother. Brothers and sisters, if we could first agree upon a dialectical principle that quantitative increase or quantitative decrease causes a qualitative leap or change, I think we can move forward to understand the flux of motion and everything. Well, he lost half the brothers and sisters. These are party members. Well, I said, Huey, let me do it, man. Me? Today, we're going to get down to the nitty-gritty, and we ain't going to miss no nits or no grits. I write dialectical or dialectics upon the board. Put the syllables up. I say, brothers and sisters, y'all want to know what that means? It ain't nothing but an argument. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Quantitative increase, quantitative decrease. I underline increase, and I underline decrease. I say, ain't nothing but addition and subtraction. Basic function of all mathematics, basic function of all mathematics, addition and subtraction. Somebody from North, no, Chairman, you forgot about multiplication. Multiplication is nothing but a fast way of adding, brother. Division, subtraction, when you take the whole and you divide a piece, it's a form of subtraction. Greater than, less than, what have you, et cetera. The functions are all there. Quantitative increase, quantitative decrease cause a qualitative leap or change. The application of that. You break it down for brothers and sisters and make them understand in the basics. You know, so, but our differences, not in an antagonistic way, was that we had to talk on the level of what the people ought to organize them in a more concrete way. We had to incorporate what it was and the class analysis. So anyway, that's all to tell you still the struggle continues for economic liberation this time. In the 1960s, if you want to talk about African-American people's history, and remember, African and African-American people's liberation is interconnected and interrelated with all human liberation on the face of this earth. It is not disconnected, it's interconnected. You have to understand that. All power to the people. Thank you very much.
That was Bobby Seale, the Black Panther Party. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bobby Seale co-founded the Black Panther Party and was its first chairperson. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, we've always offered AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. That's why we can do programs such as the one you just heard, or a whole month of Howard Zinn classics, or others with Angela Davis, Richard Wolff, David Corton, Helen Caldicott, and Tariq Ali. To access our complete audio archive, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Bobby Seale, the Black Panther Party, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Chuck Rossino recorded the program. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Gil Scott-Heron. Did you hear what they said?
Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said another brother's dead. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. Come on, come on.